just came out.
I'd like to bring the House Committee on Business and Labor to order Monday, May 8th. We're going to start out by opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 298A.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this is the measure that was introduced by the Senate Interim Committee on the Workforce, and it extends the sunset for 4 years to the year 2021 on provisions that grant the Commissioner Boley discretion in seeking civil penalties or appearing in court on housing discrimination claims. It declares an emergency. The Senate vote on this measure was 29-0.
Thank you. Paloma Sparks.
Good afternoon, Chair Hulvey, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Paloma Sparks of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of Senate Bill 298A. I'll sort of take you back and refresh what we're talking about that would have sunsetted this year. In 2015, Boley pursued legislation to allow us to have some more discretion in housing cases. That was Senate Bill 380. Currently, or prior to 2015, if somebody filed a housing discrimination complaint with Boley and then withdrew to file the case in civil court, we were required to continue to represent them, paying DOJ to represent the agency. That got to be quite costly prior to 2015, so we pursued some legislation to allow us to have discretion in determining whether or not we would continue to pursue cases that have withdrawn to civil court. That requirement that we continue to represent cases was a requirement of the federal HUD contract. We no longer have that HUD contract. From what I understand, they'll probably be making some budget cuts in HUD anyways, so at least for the time being, not the most cost-effective way for us to move forward. HUD did not pay us for our actual costs in pursuing those housing discrimination complaints, so really just wasn't a cost-effective thing for us to do. So in 2015, you passed Senate Bill 380, which gave us some discretion in whether or not to continue representing cases in civil court and whether or not to file formal charges after we had done an investigation. That discretion will sunset in 2017 without your action, so we urge your support of Senate Bill 298A, which will extend the sunset out to 2021.
Thank you. Questions? Do you see a reason for continuing to sunset this into the future? Will things change, or it seems like the sunset? Just getting rid of the sunset discussed on the Senate side?
As originally introduced, Senate Bill 298 would have eliminated the sunset altogether and would have made our discretion permanent. I believe the Senate was interested in seeing more data before they made that change permanent. And we have relatively limited data. What we can say is that at this point, it appears that we're being more successful at settling cases rather than moving forward to litigation.
Interesting. Okay, I'm not seeing any other inquiries. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
No one else was set to testify on Senate Bill 298. And so I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 298A, and we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 336.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this bill was introduced by the Senate Committee on Business and Transportation. It allows a construction contractor or a business to temporarily operate without a responsible managing individual if the responsible managing individual ceases service in that role. No amendment. There is minimal expenditure impact, no revenue impact. Senate vote on this measure was 28-0.
Thank you. And we have Kimberly Wood. Good afternoon. If you'd just introduce yourself for the record.
Good afternoon, Chair Holvey and members of the committee. My name is Kimberly Wood. I'm the Director of Corporate Risk Management for Perlow Construction. While I was the chair at the Construction Contractors Board, I became aware of an incident where which led to this piece of legislation, and I'm speaking to you today to encourage you to support Senate Bill 336. I became aware of a subcontractor who had lost their RMI around the time their license was renewed, and since they only had the one RMI for their company, they were unable to renew their license. This jeopardized their business as well as any projects they were working on, as they were operating as an unlicensed contractor at the time until they could get another RMI in place. As a general contractor, a commercial general contractor, our company checks CCB licenses for all of our subcontractors, and had this occurred on one of our projects, we would have required the subcontractor to stop work until they were properly licensed, which would have impacted the cost of construction not only for our company but also for that company. If it were for a residential project, it would also place the homeowners at risk. Perlow Construction hires hundreds of subcontractors each year, and we believe this legislation will allow contractors to remain compliant with CCB's rules and regulations by allowing companies to continue operating while working towards a replacement RMI. I'd be happy to answer any questions if you have any.
Questions?
Otherwise, thank you so much.
Representative Fahey.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Was there a conversation on the Senate side about actually putting in a timeline in the bill instead of leaving the discretion to make rules or to the CCB?
I don't recall a conversation that went along those lines, and my understanding is that the CCB would promulgate some rules that would address that time frame.
Okay.
So just another question.
Sure.
How does a company operate without somebody responsible for managing it to start with? I mean, this interim period you're talking about sounds like nobody's responsible for running the company.
Well, so there's always somebody, right?
Well, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. So what is the difficulty with replacing an RMI that, because I think the RMI is there to basically protect the company and the public, and
sure.
So it bothers me to hear that there's this period of time where the company doesn't have anybody designated that's responsible for running the company or the activities the company is doing.
Right. So I think that's a great observation, and I think there's the technical RMI, which requires you to have taken some classes and to met some criteria, and then there's being a business owner, which most businesses were before this legislation was introduced. They were running their construction companies without anybody designated as an RMI. And so I think that there's still people who are responsible that are running the company. It's just that they have not taken the courses that have to be taken, and that's what sort of takes a little bit of time. It's a pretty significant test, I think, and it takes a little bit of time to study it and then to go to schedule the test and take it. And so what I was concerned with is the amount of time that it takes to do that. You can have a sub on a job, and to be in compliance with CCB, you really need to remove them if you're aware of it. I think what happens sometimes is they kind of fly under the radar because they know they have to stop doing business if they don't have another RMI set up. And a lot of businesses don't take the time. We have a lot of small contractors in this state, and the funds that it takes to take the class is just an investment they don't make. So they just have one of their partners or owners take the exam instead of having multiples. And so this sort of alleviates that situation where somebody leaves, maybe somebody retires, and they're the RMI, and before the next person gets their RMI, the license expires, and then they're in a sort of a pickle.
So does this scenario, I guess I'm assuming things, but it doesn't actually say in the language that this previous RMI that just ceased to exist, is he still working for the company? Because I don't see that, or has he left the company? Because under the bill, it looks like he can still be working for the company. He's just no longer the RMI anymore.
Okay.
And maybe I can ask the CCB that question.
Yeah, it might be. Well, to me, if they're still working there, they could still be the RMI, because there's, so long as they're still physically there, they could, they've already passed the test, they already qualify, so there's no reason why they would. It's not required to be a business owner to be the RMI, so it could be that they've sold their share, but they remain. So I don't know if that scenario would exist. I think it's more the situation where somebody unexpectedly dies, or a company's not paying close enough attention, and somebody retires, and they find themselves without an RMI.
Yeah, maybe I could get Construction Contractors Board Jim come up and help out with a couple of these questions. So, Jim, I'm a little concerned about a company operating without a responsible managing individual. I understand the perhaps that they haven't qualified with the educational requirements to be an RMI, and just sort of concerned about that. Then I'm also concerned because sometimes RMIs are when they're found violating certain laws, they're not eligible to be RMIs, and in that case, they were the responsible individual for the company, and they're just saying, okay, this guy's not our RMI anymore, but we're going to keep working, and we're going to keep working while this RMI, previous RMI, may still be working for the company, may not be working for the company. Just, there seems like a kind of a loophole or something in here that's not making sense for me. So how does this work?
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, for the record, Jim Denno, the CCB administrator. This bill is really crafted to address a very narrow situation. Ms. Wood described it quite well as when a contractor is engaged in a job and their RMI leaves the company, becomes ill, is deceased, or something that incapacitates them. It allows us to put some rules in place for that. Outlines a process for replacing that person. Right now, we have to give them some time anyway, because the only action that we can really take is to issue a notice of intent to suspend the license. When we become aware of an RMI who's left, that's the first action that we have to take, and then that gives them, that in itself gives them 21 days to request a hearing and so forth. So it made a lot more sense to us and industry to put a place in rule where, and we did have some discussions about what the process would look like. I think the bill states that they have to notify us in writing within 3 days, and then the board would adopt rules which would say something to the effect that they have 21 days or 30 days to get another RMI appointed and qualified. So it's really about that situation where the RMI is, for one reason or another, gone from the company.
Right. I guess what I was pointing out, this bill doesn't talk about them being gone from the company, though. The person could still be working for the company.
Right.
Under this bill. And so I'm just a little concerned about this gap while you're waiting for somebody to meet the qualifications. It seems like maybe the RMI should default to the owner or that they appoint somebody else.
And those are
because I'm just worried, the implications of a company operating without anybody responsible for what they do.
Sure.
Well, for this 21 days or however long. It just doesn't seem like a really good solution to me.
Well, the solution we have now is that they just have to stop working.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Which isn't a good solution either.
That was the deal. We're not really in the business of putting contractors out of business unnecessarily. So unless it's an enforcement or a disciplinary type of issue, we want to have a process that allows them to keep going.
But that's kind of what generates my concern. If it's for a disciplinary or some sort of violation, and then the RMI decides to leave because of that, we're just going to, continue to allow this operation to continue without anybody being responsible. Doesn't seem like a great solution to me.
Well, these are the details that were going to be put into rule. So I don't know. Maybe you think you need an amendment to the bill to be able to move it forward. that would specify that the RMI has left the company or something like that.
I mean, that would help me a bit, because right now it doesn't appear that they even left the company. They're just not. I'm not the RMI anymore, you know, but I'm still going to be running this job over here. So I don't know. I'm just uncomfortable with it. I know it passed the Senate without much conversation, probably, but well, Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So is this a rule that they have that there must be an RMI in the company or business? It says business or construction to basically be responsible for the overall oversight of the project?
Chair Holby, Representative Barreto, that's correct. Anyone licensed under ORS 701, which is the contracting law, has to have an RMI, someone responsible for the business.
Does that ever fall back to the owner of the company? I mean, if you don't have a manager there, but you have a team of people that have been working for any length of time that know their jobs and know what to do, does that responsibility then come back and fall upon the company ownership?
I think, Chair Holby, Representative Barreto, I think typically a company would, like in Ms. Wood's case, that company, if they lost their RMI, they would have somebody there who could become RMI pretty quickly, within probably a matter of days. They could pass the test and take over that role.
But to Representative Barreto's point, and one I was trying to make, it seems like there should be the ability to designate by default, you know, somebody else to be to be that RMI going forward while they're looking for a new one or while somebody else is trying to qualify for it. It just doesn't seem like a great scenario to have a company that doesn't have anybody responsible for it, and yet they're actually doing business, you know, and activities for the simple fact they haven't done the educational requirements yet. So I would think some sort of designee by default or by company choice should be something we should consider, rather than just saying, we're going to give you 30 days to replace it. You can continue to operate with nobody responsible. I don't know. I haven't quite got there yet. So.
Well,
Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I was thinking a little bit different than that, in that you already have all these people that are already responsible. They've been doing the job for a long time. They've been in the union or in the job, and so it really takes maybe very little guidance for them to say, here's your job. You know what it is. And basically, good managers do that. They develop these people and their Lotus Light. So.
Right. Well, Chair Holby, Representative Barreto, I understand these concerns, and this relates specifically to the responsibility for the license. So companies will have a number of staff, all of whom are typically capable of doing the work, but this relates specifically to the responsibility for the contractor's license. So our discussions related to putting these kinds of details into rule. But if you feel that the bill needs to have those details in it, then you could we could consider amending it.
Yeah, we'll take that under consideration. I'm just not real comfortable that, say, a business may temporarily operate without a responsible managing individual. Just that statement right there in the statute, just I don't care what kind of rulemaking you do, you're not going to change that language, and that's the language that bothers me, that you can operate without somebody being responsible. I just think that opens up a lot of questions. You know, for me anyway. So I'll have that we can continue to work on this, but maybe you can make me more comfortable with it, but I'm not sure. Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is, since people are incentivized to generally have one person, that's what it appeared from your testimony, what are the barriers to people getting more than one? Is it cost? Is it the difficulty of the process? Can you explain that a little bit?
Chair Holby, Representative Bynum, the process is to take a two-day class, basically a 16-hour class, and pass the exam. So there's really no barriers to that. The law says that a contractor must have at least one RMI, so there's nothing preventing it. But for whatever reason, many do not get more than one.
Follow up.
Is there a cost to the class, and what's the pass rate on the exam?
Chair Holby, Representative Bynum, there is a cost to the class. Those are done by private providers, so I couldn't tell you off the top of my head what they cost. And the contractor exam is $65, I think.
And the pass rate?
And the pass rate is 75%, something like that, 80 maybe.
Chair Holby.
That's why I won't be bringing a CC bill forward.
I believe it's about $2,500 to take the class itself. I think that's when we checked into it. It was $2,500 was the last. That was several years ago, so I don't know what the going rate was. But it wasn't a cheap class for a small contractor. It really could make. When you couple that with the 16 hours, 2 days away from work, it does become an impact for smaller contractors, not larger ones, but certainly for smaller ones, that becomes an issue.
And you use a third party educator for this test, I guess?
Chair Holby, yeah, the law requires us to use private, and there's a whole array of them.
Yeah.
Some may charge as much as $2,500, but I don't believe that's the average, and I think there are even online options too.
So are there rules capping what that test might cost?
Chair Holby, I don't believe we have rules around the cost of the
test.
Not the test. We administer the test. That's $65.
The class, excuse me, the RMI yeah. class.
But there's a competition. There's a whole array of providers.
On the job.
Okay.
Or at least supervisor
competition, but no cap on the amount this charge for the class.
I don't believe so, sir.
All right. All right. Well, we talked that one for a while. Well, thank you for bringing this issue forward. Doesn't happen very often, but it's certainly making me think a little bit. So any other questions? Not seeing it. Thank you very much. Then I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 336 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 722A.
All right. Mr. Chair and committee members, this is a measure sponsored by the Senate Judiciary Committee. It allows a fee of no more than $100 for debt management service providers who improves or preserves a consumer's credit history but does not conduct other activities. It allows the fee to increase to $120 if the director of DCBS agrees. It allows the consumer to void the contract for debt management services if charged fees that are above the legal limit. And it prohibits the consumer from waiving this right. Allows the director to adjust fees by rule. The dash A3 amendment clarifies that the fees that are being discussed are monthly fees. And the Senate vote on this measure was 29-0.
All right, Jim Gardner.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner, and I'm appearing today for the Lexington Law Firm. The Lexington Law Firm is a large, specialized firm headquartered in Salt Lake City, doing business nationally, which specializes in the area of credit repair. Credit repair is an important consumer service because your credit rating affects a lot more than just your ability to get a loan. It can affect your ability to get a job, to get insurance, and what you pay for insurance, and even to open a bank account. Credit errors in credit ratings, problems with credit ratings, are issues that can be addressed, particularly with the help of an expert entity like Lexington. The reason the bill is here is that the existing law does not really establish a fee structure for credit repair services. It establishes other types of fee caps, which you will see in the bill on page one. For instance, a monthly fee. This is for instances when an entity will take in money from a debtor and then parcel it out to creditors. So there is an appropriate fee cap for that, as you see on line 11 of the bill and then on line 16. The intent on the Senate side was to establish an appropriate fee, which was intended to be monthly, but monthly was not called out in the bill, of $100 a month. We worked closely with DCBS in developing this bill, but late last week, I think some concerns were raised by DCBS about the appropriateness of that monthly fee. They frankly felt it was a little too high. We are continuing to work with them with regard to what an appropriate fee level would be. But it's important, I think, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, that we have a structure in place that allows an appropriate level of fee, because this service is really a very important one for consumers. Let me leave it there, Mr. Chair, and see if there are questions. I would call to your attention the fact that other categories of debt management services do have monthly fee caps. You'll see it on page one, line 15 of the bill. This is a situation where funds are actually being managed, and that's $65 a month. And likewise on page two, line four, again, $65 a month.
And that's in addition to the initial fee
$50. Yes, Mr. Chair.
Initial fee. So the question was whether this $100 was an initial fee or
that's it. And it was. I think the legislative record is pretty clear in the committee that it was intended to be monthly, but it doesn't spell out monthly, and you don't want to leave something like that ambiguous.
Okay.
But we're Mr. Chair, we are continuing to work with DCBS on what an appropriate level would be. I simply called out that provision in the existing law for other categories of debt management services.
So is your intent to have a different fee for different types of services?
No, the only service we're concerned about is credit repair service. And that one doesn't have, in the existing law, there is no fee structure or fee cap for that.
So a credit repair service is not a debt management company?
It is a subcategory of it, but it differs from the fee structure that is laid out in the statute, because it doesn't involve taking in money from the debtor and then parceling it out to creditors.
Okay. Questions? Representative Fahey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what's the current situation now? How are companies compensated?
It's a good question, Mr. Chair, Representative Fahey. So we the company initially believed that there is an attorney carve-out in the existing law, but it only applies to incidental services and only applies, interestingly enough, to an individual lawyer, not a law firm. So that simply doesn't work in terms of what this Lexington does. So we entered into a consent order agreeing not to charge, essentially, in Oregon. We're continuing to serve some clients, but essentially free of charge, just because of, you know, we'd signed them up and we're not going to leave them out in the cold. But we can't continue to do that.
Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So does someone need a license to do this? Or
a law degree. And it has to be admitted to the bar.
Okay.
To do what we do. And then there is an application process in addition to that under DCBS. So you do need a license from them to do this as well.
follow up? Maybe we could get DCBS to come up.
So, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Rick Blackwell, policy manager with DFR within, or the Division of Financial Regulation within DCBS. So, anything I can answer for the committee?
Well, I'm just trying to parse out the different types of debt management companies, and we're not trying to create a different fee schedule for credit repair. I'm just confused how credit repair is not. This isn't working for them now.
Right. So, Chair Holvey and members of the committee, so what happened in the 2009 law was that several statutes in the ORSs were combined into one umbrella registration. So a person that receives a debt management registration under law can do credit repair. They can do debt consolidation, which is paying bills for someone that's got some credit issues. Debt settlement, which is offering to negotiate a lower amount of payment to creditors. So usually it's kind of like the legal doctrine of accord and satisfaction where you take pennies on the dollar. But at the time, settlement was actually running up quite a bit of issues where people would save years worth of money or try to and drop out of the program. And then the fourth is actually loan modification. At the time, there was a rash of problems in the housing market around foreclosures and the like. And so we wanted folks that were doing short sales and other types of loan mods to get this registration. So anyone with that registration can do those four types of activities. Unfortunately, the 2009 law didn't really have any provisions for fee structures for credit repair, so it's been unclear as to what they're able to charge. So we have been, after a work group was convened in the Senate side on a different bill, Senate Bill 337, we have been working with Jim's outfit and some other stakeholders to try to find that appropriate balance of what can a credit repair entity charge for the activities that they conduct for consumers.
And I guess what I'm trying to get at, are you looking for a different fee schedule for credit repair than what is current for debt management companies?
Mr. Chair, the fee structure that I had referenced just a minute ago on the $65 cap and so forth, those simply don't apply to credit repair services. So actually, technically, the only fee, since we don't have the benefit of the attorney carve-out, the only fee that we can actually charge is line 7, the initial fee of not more than $50. Mm-hmm. The other ones just don't apply to us.
And the $65 doesn't apply to you?
No.
Chair Holvey, if I may add, subsection C, or I guess it's, well, yeah, this would be, so, or paragraph C of that section is for someone that's doing debt consolidation work. So this is the paying of the bills. That's 15% that they actually, that they receive for consumers, or capped at $65. And then subsection, or I guess paragraph D of that section, current law is, let's see, that's also credit repair. Or not credit repair, I'm sorry, debt consolidation. And then E is actually debt settlement. So a debt settlement company can charge up to 7.5% of the difference of what they save the consumer. And then that's the cap right there. So there is no provision right now in statute for credit repair fees. So they are compartmentalized already under current law. There would have to be some changes to allow credit repair, some similar type of fee arrangement.
Okay, now it's clearing up for me. Thank you.
Okay.
Took a little while. Monday.
One other thing, Mr. Chair. This did, the bill that Rick just mentioned, the 337, did begin its life as a essentially an expansion of the attorney carve-out, but both DCBS and DOJ felt that because there have been some bad actors in this space, which are law firms, not our client, but some other ones, felt that it was really important that DCBS retain regulatory authority, even if it's a law firm or a lawyer providing it. And we did not disagree with that. So that's how it morphed into a fee bill.
Yeah, gotcha. Makes sense to me, the pathway anyway. Well, no other questions. Thanks.
Thank you.
We'll figure it out, I'm sure. With that, no one else has signed up for Senate Bill 722. I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 722. And we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 974A.
Mr. Chair. It's a measure that was introduced by the Senate Business and Transportation Committee. It increases the required bond amount for vehicle dealers, prohibits persons that are other than the retail customers of vehicle dealers from making a claim against the vehicle dealer unless certain conditions are met. And it prohibits ODOT from issuing any new dealer certificates for persons who deal exclusively in motorcycles. No amendment. Senate vote was 29-0.
Thank you. We'll have Daryl Fuller.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Daryl Fuller on behalf of the Oregon Vehicle Dealers Association with a 29-0 vote. I mean, it's a pretty good bill. What more do you need to know, right? Okay, well, oh. A little bit more, perhaps.
A little more.
Forget which side of the building you're on. Yeah.
Vehicle dealer bonds serve two purposes in the marketplace. The first purpose they serve is as a barrier to entrance into the marketplace. If you don't qualify for the bond, you can't get the dealer's license, and it keeps you out of the business. That's an important function because there are certain people that you don't want to have a license to sell cars because they just don't have the financial background or the criminal background or there's something else in their background that would cause a bonding company to say, I don't want to write you a $40,000 bond because I don't trust you. And we trust the marketplace to serve as that barrier to entrance into the marketplace. As you slowly move that bond up, the problem you run into is at some point the bonding companies start to say, we're not going to write a bond for you, not because there's anything wrong, but because you just don't have the cash flow that we're looking for, or there are certain parts of your business because you're a small operator. And the bond shouldn't be a barrier to entrance into the marketplace for good actors who are simply small operators. And we're trying to keep the bad people out of the business. So we've got to be careful about ratcheting the bond up too much or too fast because it could interfere with good business people. The other part of the bond, of course, is when a dealership does go under or if there is a bad actor selling cars, is this allows consumers someplace to go when the dealership is out of business or doesn't have any assets to get the title or registration for a vehicle that they've purchased for when the vehicle dealer has used the money for other purposes besides paying off the lien on the vehicle, for example. So obviously you want to have the bond as large as possible to protect as many people as possible. And so there's a natural conflict between not wanting it to be too high so you keep good people in business, but not wanting it to be so low that there's no consumer recovery at all. It used to be the dealer bond when I started as a lobbyist in 1997 was $15,000. So it has incrementally increased quite a bit over the years. And the bond used to be accessible to everybody all the time. Anybody could get access to the bond, other businesses or consumers. What we discovered was because other dealers and banks and other financial institutions and auction houses and everybody else in the dealer world would know that a dealer is going under faster than consumers would know generally. And so all these other businesses would get their claims into the bonding company first, and by the time the consumers figured out that they were holding the bag, there wasn't any bond left. And so we started restricting a portion of the bond to consumers only. If you weren't a retail purchaser of a vehicle, you couldn't access portions of the bond while leaving some of the bond available for other businesses as well. What we've done with this bill is we've increased the amount of the bond from $40,000 to $50,000, so it's a modest increase in the bond. But we've restricted business access to the bond from $20,000 down to $10,000. So as fellow dealers, we would have less access. But it allows consumer-only access to the bond to go from $20,000 to $40,000. So it doubles the size of the bond while only increasing the bond by $10,000. And so we see that as a win for consumers and a win for dealers. We also make a couple of changes to motorcycle-only dealership licenses. There aren't very many of them left. Most dealers want to get a full dealer's license because if you're a motorcycle-only dealer, you can't take a car in on trade. You can't take a trailer in on trade. You can't sell a car. You can only sell motorcycles. And since there are fewer and fewer of those, we're going to slowly get those out of the business. And if you want to sell motorcycles, you'd have to just get a regular vehicle dealer's license. We provided provisions in the bill so that if you have a motorcycle-only dealership license, you get to keep it for perpetuity, but the DMV just wouldn't issue any new ones. And the bond for motorcycle-only dealerships hasn't been changed since the 1950s. So we've adjusted it up from $2,000 to $10,000, and we've reserved it for consumers only. So we think it's a great bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Questions? Representative Fahey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So can you talk a little bit more about the motorcycle dealer certificate? What's the rationale for cutting off new certificates being issued? I mean, I understand that there's not very many of them, but that's not really a rationale for saying there shouldn't be any more of them.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fahey, well, I guess I would disagree with you, but that's not a rationale. At some point, having a specialized license for only 24 people, it becomes more headache than it's worth for the agency that's doing the sort of the regulatory part of it. More and more dealers are transitioning their licenses to a regular dealership license so they can buy and sell more types of vehicles. So we believe that the number of dealers that are taking advantage of that is diminishing fast enough, and there aren't a lot of new people applying for them that we're actually asking DMV to spend a lot of time and effort on what is a diminishing part of the marketplace. The other side of that is if you've been to a motorcycle dealership lately, a $10,000 bond would cover part of one motorcycle. I mean, there is no consumer protection or very little consumer protection with a $10,000 bond, and there's historically been a significant difference between the motorcycle owner bond and the vehicle dealer bond because cars were so much more expensive than motorcycles. Not anymore. So if we were going to provide the same kind of consumer protection for motorcycle purchases as for other vehicle dealers, we'd end up having to ratchet up that bond for a motorcycle-only license closer to the $50,000, and then at that point, what's the purpose of having a motorcycle-only dealership license?
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you happen to know numbers on how many of these certificates have been issued in the last 5 to 10 years? I mean, you said they haven't been very many new ones, but do we have data on that?
I don't have it with me, but Mr. Chair, Representative Fahey, I don't, but I'll have that information to you probably by the end of the day.
Thank you.
Other questions? Well, it sounds like we've almost talked about this subject matter before in this committee. And, I'd be curious what the information you get back for Representative Fahey is.
But, I'll make sure it goes to the whole committee, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. All right, no other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you for scheduling the bill so quickly. Have a good day.
Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 974. And with that, I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 96A. Jan, can you remind us what we're...
I will, Mr. Chair, committee members. This is the bill you heard on April 24th. The bill was introduced by the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Requires proof of errors and omissions insurance policy with the application for a license or a renewal of a license as a broker-dealer or as an investment advisor. Requires insurance in the amount of $1 million, provides exemptions, no expenditure impact, no revenue impact, no amendment, and the Senate vote was 17 to 10.
Thank you. Representative Bynum, can we have a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 96A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Bynum moves Senate Bill 96A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And for discussion, maybe I'll have DCBS come up yet again. Thank you. Just trying to clear up my memory on this. As I recall this, not to get confused with the vehicle dealer bill, but this errors and omissions insurance was basically put forward as a alternative to inadequate bonds to cover consumers.
Chair Holvey and members of the committee, for the record again, Rick Blackwell with DCBS, and that's correct, yes.
Okay. Thank you for that. I just wanted to make sure I was thinking about the same bill. Are there other questions? Representative Barreto.
So, thank you, Mr. Chair. So, we talked about a million-dollar policy the last time, costing around $2,000, I think, was the number thrown out there. So, so if you look at the risk on the insurance companies, that would be 0.2% of just if that, if those dollars just covered, you know, the shortage that these people were getting, or I guess the penalty. So that would be a very small percentage of these infractions that actually take place out there, I would assume.
Chair Holvey and Vice Chair Barreto, I mean, we certainly hope so, that these this is only covering a smaller fraction of all cases. So
Follow up. So then we would be charging everybody, though, this $2,000. I mean, you would be charging all of these people that do this an extra $2,000 a year to do this, for the, I guess, what I would consider the few offenses that were caused out there.
Chair Holvey and Vice Chair Barreto, I mean, that is the basis of insurance, really, is that we hope never to use it. So.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Doherty.
This is more kind of a comment than a question, because I have quite a few senior citizens that I represent. And there have been, I won't say quite a few, but if you've got 10, that's, to me, is quite a few people who have, well, the people that have been managing their money that under the, you know, that I'm a financial advisor and stuff, literally stolen it. And so this is something that, and right now, what is it, $10,000 coverage or something like that?
Chair Holvey and Representative Doherty, correct. The bond is currently set at $10,000.
And so, you know, to have it go up to $1 million, considering the access some of these people have to people's personal retirement accounts, I think is actually, personally, I think it's too low. But it certainly is much better than what we have now.
So. Chair Holvey, if I may, and Representative Doherty, the average account, I guess the average accounts that were run by investment firm are about $170,000. So we testified last time that this is kind of the average of the accounts that for which we think would be protected by a bill like this.
And I assume the reason for not just increasing the bond to go this insurance route is that the bond becomes pretty expensive and almost not accessible to many small operators.
Chair Holvey, and that's correct. We did some rulemaking. I testified last time that we started with some rulemaking to actually increase the bond. It looked like it was going to be either prohibitively expensive or, given possible credit concerns and the like, that the bond might be unavailable to certain folks anyway.
All right. Okay. Representative Barreto, another question?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So do you have a study that says how many of these happen every year? I mean, a percentage anyway?
Chair Holvey and Vice Chair Barreto, I think I'll turn to my lifeline on that one.
Lifeline, if you would introduce yourself for the record and not as, Ms. Lifeline.
Chair Holvey, Representative Barreto, for the record, my name is Erin Tebrup. I'm a senior policy analyst for the Division of Financial Regulation. What we have is a list of complaints that are posted on our central registry database, which is where all broker-dealers and investment advisors have to disclose complaints that are against them and whatnot and so forth. So for last year, for broker-dealer representatives, we've got about 144,000 complaints in a year, and some of those are unfounded complaints. Some of them are just disclosure events that they should have disclosed something, but they didn't, and so that could leave them open to a negligence complaint, which would be covered under the errors and omissions insurance. We've got, I think, so specifically for Oregon resident investment advisors, there were about 4,000 complaints in the 365-day period. So, and again, the complaint doesn't necessarily mean that there's wrongdoing, but
right. Do you have that number?
A follow-up.
So out of 4,000 complaints, do you know how many of those were actually valid that ended up being paid?
Chair Holvey, Representative Bredo. Unfortunately, if there's some sort of deal or settlement that's been entered into, what will happen is those complaints go into archive, and we don't really know the resolution of it. And at that point, consumers can't even look up to see if there has been a complaint about that particular person. Once it goes into archives and it's being some sort of settlement's been worked out, those records are invisible to the public view. So, and we don't have access to them unless they're actually centered here and it was something that we had worked on.
So if a complaint gets settled, it becomes not undisclosable as far as somebody's record of doing business?
Representative Holvey, through the CRD, it does. So we have our investigation complaints, which would be subject to different
CRD
levels. The Central Registry Database, which is where it funnels through for all investment advisors and broker-dealers.
Okay. Other questions? Representative Kinnamer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was looking at the Senate summary. This would be the first state in the nation to use errors and omissions insurance in this instance.
Chair Holvey and Representative Kinnamer, that's correct.
In the history of that, if I may.
Follow up.
Chair Holvey and Representative Kinnamer, again, we, as we started looking at bonds, they didn't appear to be sufficient to meet the need that we were trying to address, is how to figure out if there's some reasonable measure of recovery for investors that have lost money due to negligence. The other states have gone with bonds as well. I can only speculate that perhaps because we're a combination of insurance and finance, we thought about insurance as a possible framework to try to bring that kind of recovery to folks. So that would make us the first. There are some other competing proposals. I think FINRA had a fund that would be set up, kind of like a recovery fund. Those are rather expensive to administer at a state level and probably wouldn't be very feasible given this current environment.
Chair Holvey, Representative Kenmer, if I can jump in real quick, too. There are three other states that when we pulled out to see what other states were doing this or had looked at it, there were three that said, either yes, we're looking at it now, or we're going to look at it the next time we have our bond up for increase. So it's not that the states are unaware of this as a possibility. There are other states that are looking at it.
Thank you. Other questions? Not seeing any. Thank you very much. We have a motion for a due pass recommendation on Senate Bill 96A. Kayla, could we have a roll call, please?
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Representative Evans?
Aye.
Representative Fahey?
Aye.
Representative Hack?
No.
Representative Hurd?
No.
Representative Kenmer?
No.
Vice Chair
Beretta?
No.
Vice Chair Bynum?
Aye.
Chair Holvey?
Aye. Senate Bill 96A, having received the votes, is passed. And carriers? Representative Evans? Thank you.
Yes, sir. Happy to serve, sir.
So, we close the work session on Senate Bill 96A, and that's all for our agenda today.
That's a wrap.
So with that, I'll close and or adjourn House Committee on Business and Labor, unless Jen has something else to add. Nope. We'll see you Wednesday. House Committee on Business and Labor is adjourned. House Committee on Business and Labor is adjourned.